Identification, Tape 2, Side B of the interview with Professor Matthews, and we were talking about K.C. Weir.
I first met Weir at a seminar in Australia before I went to London. I should have mentioned these two seminars. They were called Jubilee Seminars in 1951, I think funded by the Commonwealth Government on the occasion of the 50th anniversary. One was on federalism and one was on science. And despite my lack of qualifications as a scientist, I was a co-convener of both. And in fact, I was called one of the rapporteurs, but in fact, I wrote both wrote up both the records of the seminars. So this was in a day before tapes, or if they were in existence, I didn't know about them. So that what happened at each of these seminars, there were papers presented, I think they lasted for 2 or 3 days, papers presented followed by discussion. There was a problem of editing the papers, which Jeff Saw did in the case of the Federalism Seminar, and the other co-convener who came from CSIRO, I've forgotten his name, did in the case of the Science Seminar. But all the discussion I had to make notes about, and the discussion in the books on those two seminars is in fact my summary of the discussion. I might say some of the papers are also mine, because not all of the I suppose, being typically academics, not all of them had written papers, and I had to make notes. I remember Colin Clark's was written by, well, it was taken down from by me from the lecture he gave, because there wasn't a written paper. But that was my first major involvement with federalism, and of course Weir was probably the preeminent authority on the politics of federalism, if not the economics. This led also to my involvement with Mead in his seminar at LSE. There's really not much else I can tell you about Weir. I certainly can't say to what extent he was influenced by Hancock, although I think his relations with Copeland were always pretty good, which might suggest that he was independent of the Hancock-Copeland feud.
Well, Copeland presumably was responsible for enlisting him after Hancock bolted.
Yeah. I suspect so.
Did you see anything of Hancock?
Yes, of course. Hancock was very generous to me, because he provided an office in his, what was it called, the Institute of Commonwealth Studies building in 27 Russell Square in London, and he gave us the top floor of that building, which at a time of office shortage in London was a very generous gesture, and his disagreement with Copeland didn't affect that. He left the office available to the university, and during the whole of my time there he was very helpful in all sorts of ways. I think at that stage he was working on his Smuts biography, and I didn't really have any academic dealings with him. And it was after that, of course, that after Copeland had left, that he subsequently decided to go back to the ANU. My dealings with Firth I can't recollect at all. I'm not even sure that Firth wasn't out in New Zealand for part of the time. But
And Australia. He did spend a year in Australia, and it could well have been 1951.
Might well have been that time. Flory I had more to deal with, because he was a sort of guiding influence over there. And at that stage, he still hadn't finally made up his mind about whether to come to Canberra to head up the John Curtin School. So I used to go up to Flory, to Oxford occasionally to see Flory. Once again, I can't recollect the things we talked about. They're probably in the files, but sort of personal reminiscences. I remember he took me home to lunch one day, and although his home was just on the other side of a park from the lab, we had to go on a long detour around the around Oxford to get to his home, because he got such terrible hay fever if he walked across the park. Again, my knowledge, I've got a mind that tends to shut out things that I am no longer interested in. I just don't remember what those things were, what the things were that we talked about.
And Adrian Albert, too, you had some contact with.
Yes, well, mainly, again, of an administrative kind, although he also was very hospitable and helpful with his time.
And do you know if he, in turn, had much to do with Flory during that period, or did medical chemistry, I guess it was called even then, did that operate more or less in isolation from Flory's setup?
It was a separate department, no doubt, his involvement with Flory was fairly close during that time. Thing that have you finished about the advisors? Because I don't really know much more than that. One other thing that that happened in London that I should have mentioned was the work on economic policy that I did as a result of the contacts that I had with the various people that Copeland had given me introductions to. This resulted Copeland was a very good correspondent. If you wrote a letter, you'd get a letter back almost immediately, which was a bit of a problem at times. But we used to write very long letters to each other. He wanted my views about economic policy in the in the UK, which covered not only the ELEC things, but the state of the world economy generally, what was happening in the UK. Wanted me to tell him, any interesting articles and so on that might have come out. And as a result, we had a very fruitful correspondence during the whole of the time I was in the UK, half of which seems to have got lost. I've got copies of my letters to him, but in the National Library files, but the Melbourne University biographer of Copeland, Marge Harper, said that copies of his letters to me don't seem to be around anymore, which is a pity, because it would have been useful to go back and look at these again after all these years. A lot of the issues have re-emerged quite recently. Anyway, I was scheduled to go back to Adelaide in March 1953. Just before I went to that conference for the ELEC in Brussels, which was a one of the major conferences, I think, that that led to the formation of the common market, although Britain progressively kept apart from the steps that led to the common market. I think they'd already had a an iron and steel community, and there were other moves which the European countries wanted to make to cement the relationship with the UK, mainly because of its links with the Commonwealth countries tended to be reluctant to do. You know, one of the things that happened at the Brussels conference was that I, this was 2 days, I think, before, 3 days before I was due to come home, I fell over in the street after having some sort of bilious attack and cracked my skull on the pavement, and I was unconscious for about 6 or 7 hours at a time when I was supposed to be going back to London, and I completely lost my memory. I remember Lady Rhys Williams bending over me, trying to tell me who I was, but not having the faintest recollection of this. But fortunately, my memory came back, and I was able to get a late plane back to London in time. I think the next day I had to hand the car in for shipment to Australia, and the next day I had to go up to Oxford to see Florey, I think, for some final briefings. And then we had the sea trip back to Adelaide, and I had the job there of developing new courses. This was the first degree course in accounting that they'd established, and for the first few years I was the only full-time lecturer, and I had to develop new courses in Accounting 1 and Accounting 2, using part-time lecturers for the more professional accounting courses. And at the same time I maintained my interest in public finance by giving the public finance lectures in Economics 3 and the National Accounting lectures in Economic Statistics 1. Most of my publications during this period were in finance, or both company finance and public finance, but arising out of my lecture notes, I started to put together a book on accounting for economists, which was published around about 1961, I think. And my interest on the accounting side was my main interest on the accounting side, apart from national accounting, was completely divorced from public finance in being concerned with accounting theory, the theory of income measurement. And most of my international publications at that stage were publications in overseas journals were on this income measurement thing, which in some ways also meshed in with my interest in public finance, but at that stage was different. Well,
you were, if I can just butt in, reading commercial studies first and then professor of commerce. What's in the name? Did it concern you that you might at one time be described as professor of commerce, although you might equally have been a professor of economics, specialising in certain areas?
I was happier with the title professor of commerce than reader in commercial studies, because reader in commercial studies seemed to suggest a fairly narrow interest in accounting and the other subjects that we taught were commercial law, whereas my interests were much wider than that. In fact, during the period I was in Adelaide, we developed courses in business finance. I didn't do this. Other economists helped me to do this as part of the accounting courses, so that commerce was much more general. The way I became Professor of Commerce was that I was offered the chair of accounting at the University of Melbourne when Alex Fitzgerald, who was the first professor there, retired. And I really wanted to stay in Adelaide, which was a marvellous school in those days. It had, you know, many of the leading academic economists in Australia. But the offer of a chair wasn't one I was really prepared to pass up, especially going back to Melbourne, which I would have been very happy to do. But Peter Carmel, again, how he did it, I don't know. He couldn't have been able to do it nowadays. He got the university to agree, almost overnight, to agree to a chair. And was called a chair of commerce, and I took it on. In the other things about Adelaide that have a bearing on what happened later in the ANU were that in 1959 I went on study leave, Ross Honan had been largely instrumental, I think, in getting me a Carnegie grant for about 5 months' travel in the UK, which was another marvellous experience and also part of my apprenticeship in many ways. I spent this time partly on my ordinary academic studies. I gave a paper to the American Accounting Association in Boulder, and I spent time in a number of American universities, Duke at Durham and Berkeley, ones I spent most time at, University of Pennsylvania at Philadelphia. I gave lectures in most of these places and sat in on seminars. But the two main purposes of the visit were to look at MBA programs in America. This was done with Peter Carmel's support, with the idea of introducing an MBA program into Adelaide. And the other thing was to look at what was happening in computing in universities. It was still a very embryonic field, but I'd been involved in the early computer society in Adelaide, and I thought it was time that we started to show some interest in that field also.
How did that involvement begin? Whose initiative was it that you became interested in computers? Was it just something that you...
Actually, my interest was purely... a lay interest in those days, but it developed, I think, through my reading of the obvious applications of computing to accounting, when a computer society was formed, Adelaide being a fairly small community in those days, I just became a member.
The applications are obvious today, but were they obvious then?
No, except that in the accounting courses I was leading up to this by showing how the forerunners of computing, punch card systems and that sort of thing were applicable to accounting. We were showing our students, you couldn't show them a computing application, there wasn't one, but you were showing them punch card applications, and from reading of the literature, which I became quite interested in, reading a biography of that marvellous man Babbage, for example, in the 19th century, who developed the first computer but couldn't get it to work because there was no electricity. I used to talk to my students about these things, but not as a computer expert, and I still am not a computer expert. It wasn't until 1966 that I did a computing course at UCLA when I was teaching there, and the program I developed in that course as my assignment, which was to put a complete accounting system on a computer using a different method of accounting, a matrix accounting system instead of a double entry accounting system, was written up for an Australian journal. It was in fact published in as a reprint by request in an American computing journal, which made me rather proud, except that I still didn't know anything about computing. In those days, of course, to write a program, you had to go through the big central university computer and punch out cards. If you made the slightest mistake, you'd get a rude message back and you'd have to start again. It could take days. Anyway, this program worked quite well, but that was my only, and has been to date, my only academic interest in computing. But it still seemed to me that computing was something, this is going back to 1959 now, that computing was something that needed to be done in universities. So that I visited people outside universities, mainly in computing, IBM establishments and so on. But I went to most of the leading business schools, the graduate business schools in American universities, and I wrote a report when I came back proposing a Master of Business Management degree in Adelaide. And this, in fact, was the first proposal for, as far as I know, for a multidisciplinary master's degree in any Australian university of any kind, not only management. And it was certainly the first proposal for a Master of Business Administration degree in Australia. That was still thought in those days to be rather beneath the contempt.
You used the expression multidisciplinary then?
I did, yeah.
Having borrowed it from the United States, or what's the term already in popular usage?
I'm not sure where it came from. It may even have come from the objections to the degree from people in Adelaide University who said a master's degree should not be multidisciplinary. But I think I would have used it in my proposal, copies of which I still have in my personal files in the National Library. And this proposal, again with Peter Carmel's support, was fully accepted within the economics faculty at Adelaide. It was multidisciplinary in the sense that it would have involved accounting, economics, statistics, behavioural studies. I think in the jargon of the time we used to call the statistics quantitative studies. We didn't include very much on the sort of nuts and bolts of management. I think there might have been something on organisation theory, but not very much on the functional areas of management, marketing and that sort of thing was not included. Anyway, as I said, we had the support of the economics faculty, but it stirred up a hornet's nest in the university, and virtually the whole of the rest of the university objected to this proposal. They said that you couldn't... It was also the first master's degree by coursework. I think in any Australian university. By the time we'd got it through Adelaide, the University of New South Wales had brought in a similar proposal, and their degree started in the same year as the Adelaide one. But people in the university, and I had to fight through board after board and special committee after special committee to get the thing established. They said it was, first of all, business administration was not an academic discipline. It wasn't a respectable subject. This was something that accounting had gone through some years before and was still going through in some universities, although it had been accepted in Adelaide since before the time I was there. Secondly, it was multidisciplinary, and everybody knew that master's degrees had to be concentrations on a singular discipline. Thirdly, it was a... it was a coursework degree. Did I say that before? And everybody knew that master's degrees had to be degrees by thesis. So the only way we could eventually get this degree established in the end was to agree, very unwillingly on my part, to have an MBM degree that had a full 2 years of coursework, supplemented in the case of people who hadn't done the preliminary work necessary to do the coursework at a high enough standard by bridging courses, which would be fairly normal. There was no problem about that. Supplemented also by a thesis requirement that they wrote in should be of Master 8 standard, whatever that means.
But they Master 8
standard, M-A-S-T-E-R-A-T-E, that's what they said in the regulations. So that, in other words, the poor students are required to do a full coursework degree, which in any American university would have qualified them for an MBA by itself, plus a full degree by thesis. Needless to say, the number of enrolments was not very high, even though it was high enough to justify the course, but then the other trick was played that they just didn't provide enough funds to provide staff, so it was left to the economics faculty to provide the staff from existing resources, which was another way of killing something dead, and that also happened in the end year later. That's another story. Really soured me off, and these discussions were still, at least the consequences of this, were still with me in 1963 when they decided to establish the chair of accounting and public finance in the ANU. Apparently, one of the reasons for linking accounting and public finance was a fairly obvious one, that these were important subjects in Canberra. The other was that I think they were rather interested in getting me with my joint interest. They didn't want a straight academic accountant to take the job. They wanted somebody with an economics interest as well.
Well, these are matters we need to explore closely,
yeah.
But perhaps we might leave them to our next session.
Yeah. Mm.